Sacramento's tent city has captured international attention, and now there's a proposal to kick out hundreds of homeless folks. Mayor Kevin Johnson unveiled his solution to the homeless problem today.
And he admitted all the attention prompted the city to act quickly.
Technically, the United States is already bankrupt.
I don't think anybody's looking for a fight. They're just looking for a place to live.
This is Radio EcoShock. Hello, I'm Alex Smith, and this week we're going to take a quick cruise through the battered economy. Like the economist Paul Krugman wrote in the New York Times, the latest news and government moves almost left me in utter despair. I didn't want to make this program, until I realized, as I waded through it all, there was another stream developing in the back of my mind. Things to learn, personal solutions that I could share with you, an antidote, perhaps, to the poison economy. So you'll get all the desperation a mind can stand, I promise you, but I've also got four solid tips for you, tiny ways out that might make you better prepared for the hard times to come. Stay tuned for that. We have an interview, a new take on the "We'll Work for Food" sign, and two radio reports from independent journalists. George from California takes us on a tour of people living in their cars, while CKUT Radio brings out powerful voices from a tent city in Nashville, Tennessee. It's an example of how we get news without newspapers in the digital democracy. Independent journalism for you. Let's start with the banksters, the victims, and Obama's latest national TV address. According to a report from MarketWatch, many Americans are just, quote, a paycheck or two from ruin. Millions do not have enough savings to cover even a month's worth of expenses. And this includes many in the middle class as well as the poor. Countless Americans living in expensive houses are sweating out this month's bills, hoping to make it through. The article by Jennifer Waters, published March 18th, collects data from a number of recent surveys. These found, quote, roughly 60% of the population was ill-prepared financially before the meltdown struck. That's the end of that quote. Another study by MetLife discovered half of Americans have only a month's worth of savings, two paychecks before default or bankruptcy. 28% surveyed could last only 2 weeks. Almost a third of those making over $100,000 a year said they could just last a month without their job. Another study by the Pew Center reported that 86% of consumers, rich and poor, have cut back on spending, even those who had not lost any job or income. Well, that could be good news for the environment. The major banks of America are insolvent. This has been reported by most major news outlets and acknowledged by the repeated bailouts by the government. Now, American credit unions are threatened by the same problems. Wanting to invest their members' money in something tangible, they bought trumped-up mortgages, which are now crashing in value. On March 20th, federal regulators took control of two big institutions at the heart of the credit union system. These so-called corporate credit unions mediate payments between at least 10,000 retail credit unions, the ones that are joined and used by the public, you and I. The government's National Credit Union Administration seized U.S. Central Federal Credit Union, based in Kansas, and Western Corporate Federal Credit Union in California. These two had assets over $55 billion. U.S. Central expected to lose $1.2 billion from bad mortgage-backed securities. The government has already promised $40 billion in aid for corporate credit unions and guaranteed up to $250,000 per account, as they do for banks. Without the weekend takeover of these credit union clearinghouses, the cash might have stopped flowing through 7,800 U.S. credit unions. So it's not just the banks, folks. China is the world's top steelmaker, you might know. Steel exports from the Asian giant are projected to drop by 80% this year. After a glut of overproduction, the world has stopped making things. Instead of being the world's steel exporter, China may actually import more steel this year. And Japan, the world's second largest economy and heavily dependent on exports, experienced another month of a 50% drop in exports. The economy there is in a shambles. Westerners aren't buying cars and new digital gear. Now, when you see the U.S. Federal Reserve buying U.S. treasuries, you know serious problems are blowing up in the back rooms of government finance. The Chinese leaders are questioning whether treasuries, the debt which funds all U.S. government operations now, are really worth much. The Chinese are the single largest owners of U.S. treasuries. If they or the Saudis decided to sell, you can lock up the doors of Congress and send the politicos home. There won't be any money to pay government employees or programs. We are dependent on those two countries. The head of the biggest Chinese bank is also suggesting a new world currency to replace the U.S. dollar. If that happens, America would collapse for sure. If foreigners don't need and buy U.S. dollars, there isn't much else keeping the U.S. economy afloat these days. We have to wonder if a major treasury owner, say a sovereign wealth fund, didn't threaten to get out. There are dinosaurs stumbling around in the dark, folks, that we never hear about. Even on the surface, we know that the Chinese, Japanese, and Germans will buy fewer treasuries this year just because their exports have dropped so much. They have less to trade to exchange for U.S. government debt. How will the Obama administration pay for so much more? All the big wigs are already talking about how the U.S. is really bankrupt. Here's Purina Saxena, a quick clip from CNBC just this past week.
To try and create inflation. So deflation is just a temporary asset liquidation phase in the markets. We are more concerned about sky-high inflation down the road, possibly even hyperinflation in some countries, because if you look at the economies in the West, the United States, Spain, Ireland, the UK, technically the United States is already bankrupt because they have a debt of over $55 trillion. The size of the economy is only about $14 trillion. So if the creditors turned up today and said, we want the money back, they would either default or they would have to print huge amounts of money. And to my knowledge, at least, no democratic government ever in history has opted for the default route. What they do, they basically print money and make sure that the value of the money goes down so it's easier to repay those debts.
The U.S. government shows there is a way to sell treasuries, namely to sell them back to another arm of the government. I'll lend money to myself, says the debtor, who just makes up more trillions using a laser printer in the back office. Every major financial publication admits this move to buy our own treasuries is the last desperate gamble by the biggest gambler in the world. The administration admits it's thrown everything but the kitchen sink at this economic crisis. Buying their own debt is the kitchen sink. To me, it's a sign to get ready for the toughest of tough times.
Well, listen, Mr. Guyton has been bombing for 15 years. Mr. Biden caused this job, this problem. You know, Mr. Guyton has been head of the New York Fed for several years. That was the office that was supposed to be supervising Wall Street and the banking system. He caused the problem. Then all last year, he came up with TARP. He came up with all these absurd bailouts. Listen, Mr. Guyton has never known what he's doing. He doesn't know what he's doing now. And pretty soon, everybody's going to find out, including Mr. Obama.
The other major economic news comes from Tim Geithner's suicidal plunge down the black hole of toxic assets. Boy, wouldn't you love to have some toxic assets. It's just what you want to eat. Geithner sat with all the top bankers on the privately owned Federal Reserve of New York before being tapped by Obama to run the Treasury. Barack chose this Republican banker's man to run the company's Treasury. Why? The new plan is a regurgitation of Bush's man, the Goldman Sachs CEO Hank Paulson, to push up to $1 trillion into the big bank, buying toxic assets from the taxpayers' money. This is a mess of legal paperwork poised on top of shaky subprime mortgages with the blessings of so-called ratings agencies who lied about it. The banks hold toxic assets on their books valued up to $250 billion or more. Their real value is low to nothing. Even $1 trillion is just a drop in the ocean of derivatives floating out there. Not much in a $250 billion problem. This is a double tragedy. First, as economists like Paul Krugman pointed out in the New York Times, it won't work. Second, these mistakes, some say looting, in the economy will burn out the political goodwill felt for Barack Obama. The banksters are hosing him and us at the most critical time in all human history. Think what $1 trillion could do for replacing coal power with solar and wind, for building high-speed rail, for saving our climate.
Hey, Paul Krugman. Why aren't you in the administration? Is there some kind of politicking that I don't understand? I mean, Timothy Geithner is like some little weasel. And wasn't he in a position of power? And all this shit went down in the first place. When I listen to you, things seem to make sense. I listen to him, all I hear is blah, blah, blah. Hey, Paul Krugman, where the hell are you, man? 'Cause we need you on the front lines, not just writing for the New York Times. I'd feel better if you were calling some shots instead of writing your blog and probably thinking a lot. I mean, don't you have some influence? Why aren't you Secretary of the Treasury? For God's sakes, man, you won the Nobel Prize. Timothy Geithner uses TurboTax. When I listen to you, things seem to make sense. Listen to him, all I hear is blah, blah, blah. Hey, Paul Krugman, where the hell are you, man? Obama breakdown.
Man, the economy's got everybody's attention. That's Jonathan Mann, who's been writing songs, posting it to his website at rockcookiebottom.com. In his televised address to the nation March 24th, Barack Obama did not mention the climate as a concern at all. He talked energy independence under his breath, but did not warn the American people about the new science coming out of Copenhagen, about the rising seas, storms, fires, floods, and drought coming to this nation. The country will be overwhelmed with debt or bankrupt as the climate disaster hits harder and harder in the coming decades. Worse, his whole financial talk is based, Obama told us, on a presumed growth rate of 2.6% per year. Nobody told him the age of growth is over. The toxic economy, growing at 2.6% a year, uses up the earth within the lifetimes of our children. Projections of spending built on endless growth means projection of mutual suicide for the planet's ecosphere. That's what we're planning. You will know someone truthful is in control when they outline the plan for an orderly contraction of the toxic economy, rapid withdrawal from carbon, pesticides, and the general rape of the biosphere, even a contraction in the human population, planned and humane, please. We hope it's absolutely necessary. This will happen anyway as fossil fuels run out. It is happening now in the financial world and in our local jobs market. The kill-it-for-all profit bubble is deflating like a balloon with a nail in it. Let's see what's happening in other countries. Let's go to France with the Wayne Madsen Report.
85,000 workers took to the streets of Paris in protest of the government's handling of the current financial crisis. Many of them were also on strike.
L'avenir n'est pas brillant.
The future isn't good. Every day in the newspapers you see people being sacked at Clairoix, being sacked at Dijon. We have to do something for the good of the nation.
But this wasn't the only demonstration. Another 200 protests were staged across the country, and the strike affected transport, energy, and government services. One union leader said workers have had enough.
More and more workers are starting to feel that we're not the ones who are responsible for this crisis, but we are the first victims, with job losses, wage reductions, and pressure on working conditions. We're asking the government and industry bosses to review the acts and decisions which they've been making over the years.
Polls show that three-quarters of French people support the action, and many are disillusioned with President Nicolas Sarkozy's reform pledges.
Of course we are angry with the government when you see the way they serve the banks and leave the people starving and losing their jobs. Of course we are grudging against the government.
Large public sector workforce and a generous welfare system, France is better placed than many to ride out the economic storm. But it's feared 1 in 10 people may soon be out of work in France, and the economy could contract by 2%. These demonstrations won't help, but they do make sure discontent doesn't go unnoticed.
Well, there you have it. And hopefully what's happening in France will happen in this country. It's happening in other countries. People have had it. That'll wrap things up for this week with the Wayne Madsen Report, the Saturday Roundup.
Barack Obama can talk honey out of the air. He is easily the most articulate and intelligent American president, at least since Bill Clinton and maybe beyond. It's a great relief from the dumb and evil years of George Bush and Dick Cheney. But Obama has not yet faced reality nor separated himself from his Wall Street campaign donors. His main advice for the American people, don't look back. Don't look over your shoulder. Don't look at what really happened before, during, and after 9/11. We'll leave the Bush-appointed version of history intact. Don't prosecute anyone for the torture and the horrendous war crime that ended up in thousands of dead Iraqis. Let Mr. Cheney go on with his speaking tour. Oh, and it's counterproductive to charge those who engineered and profited from the world's biggest Ponzi scheme. We need those crooks to save us now. In fact, we need the crooks to lead us, acting right in the heart of our government. We need to give them all our tax money and all the tax money from our children, all that they could ever pay, and maybe, just maybe, they'll be able to find your pension money and your savings if you have the nerve to ask for them. Nothing will be investigated. Just face forward, hope, and keep quiet about the rest. In my opinion, that is blackmail, not government. It means American government bankruptcy and even collapse becomes ever more possible. We all need to take what steps we can to find our local resource base, develop community links, and learn how to live through the developing collapse. In this program, I'm going to give you 4 illustrated tips to help you do just that. In Rolling Stone magazine and online, Matt Taibbi's March 19th article is simply titled, "The Big Takeover." Rolling on from the seeming unlimited payouts from AIG, Taibbi explains, quote, how Wall Street insiders are using the bailout to stage a revolution. Well, they may get more revolution than they bargained for, I say. Finally, understanding the financial situation, there is a good article from Global Macro Econo Monitor, dated March 18th by Rich Hartman. The title tells it all, "Nobody Knows the Price of Anything." That is the basis of this crisis. Is that $200 billion derivative collection worth $100 billion, $100 million, or nothing? How about GM stock? Nobody knows. We are not sure what gold is really worth. Estimates run from $4,000 an ounce to nothing if you are hungry and have only gold. Oil goes from $150 to $35 to anything is possible. We don't really know what the dollar is worth or any currency. Nobody can guess how much banks or industries are worth, and we certainly don't know the value of real estate. Is a gas guzzler from a soon-to-be-bankrupt auto company worth $30,000? Or nothing is a complete liability. Rich Hartman asks, will orange juice or milk be $4 next year or $20? It's pretty hard to plan, isn't it? Republicans like to say we face a crisis of values. Well, we do now. In fact, we don't know what future human life is worth. On our current carbon trajectory, we value it as zero. It's all a Moroccan bazaar now. People are guessing at costs, offering half the price and still paying too much. Your challenge as a single person in the storm is to judge what really matters to you and your family. Which is worth more, fast food bills or a year's supply of food? Because no one else knows what anything is really worth. Set up your own values and proceed accordingly. Even Peggy Noonan, hardly a radical op-ed columnist, is writing about the pandemic of fear, her words, gripping America. Gun sales are up. People are going to church. Folks are taking money from banks and putting it under the mattress while others surf the net looking for some safe place to get out. How many of us are dreaming about a nice concrete hole lined with food? Check out her article titled, "There's No Pill for This Kind of Depression," in the Wall Street Journal, March 13th. It's a good read. Oh, and that famous tent city in Sacramento, the one covered by all the American networks, Oprah, the BBC, even Al Jazeera, that's being closed down by the city. Too embarrassing. Sacramento will find shelter beds for the now famous down-and-out residents of that tent city. But a blog comment explains that, while that area floods in the spring anyway, Sacramento would have been liable if there were deaths. Meanwhile, the city is opening up more tent cities on higher ground. They'll have plenty of company. Maybe Google Maps will develop a tour of tent cities from the safe of satellite eyes. In this program, Radio EcoShock will go one better, with 2 independent reports coming from people living in cars in California to a major tent city just outside of Nashville, Tennessee. I want to showcase these 2 for another reason. We are all asking, what happens when newspapers disappear, when the journalists behind the TV networks are laid off? One answer is citizen journalism and listener-supported nonprofits, especially nonprofit radio with its low production costs. We're finding informed content in blog post comments, sometimes better written than the newspapers, and it's coming in hot, fast, and free. Our first piece is from the nonprofit Canadian station CKUT. They visited a tent city out of Nashville. We'll hear not just the hardship, but the intelligent plea for the rights coming from people thought to be discarded, lost to society. Let's listen.
So many people are, especially people in the homeless community, many of them are exceptionally smart.
Right.
And skilled, but they lack credentials often. They lack the ability to network. Many of them have very rudimentary, if at all, computer skills. And then, of course, you know, all the other things, transportation, lack of phone, lack of, a stable residence so they can shower and shave and eat before they go and got a place to come to when they come home. So all those things, I mean, you know, have conspired, especially here in Nashville, to just create this great condition for homelessness. Mm-hmm. And then when you add a lack of affordable housing units,
yeah.
You cannot. Shelter is the most basic of human needs.
Right.
So how a community can think that you cannot put resources towards affordable housing is fucking ridiculous.
Yeah.
And this tent cities really are, in my mind, the logical conclusion.
Right.
You know, it's just the way it is. I mean, what else are they going to do?
That's Steve Samra. Steve is probably the most active homeless outreach worker in Nashville. He himself was homeless and a drug addict until about 10 years ago when he went through a rehab program, went back to school. About 2 years ago, Steve and his wife moved to Nashville from Nevada, and he's been doing outreach work there ever since. He took me to a soup kitchen at the United Methodist Church, not far from Music Row, where I met Amy Gallagher. Amy is the director of the church's outreach program. It was a Friday, one of the 2 days during the week that the kitchen is open, and there are almost 200 homeless and unemployed people in the banquet hall, waiting to be fed.
There are tent cities all over, and I do not know that they will ever go away. There are certain individuals who cannot live in structured settings, and so they need a tent city. And that's always going to be there.
Have you seen a dramatic increase lately?
Absolutely. Yes, our numbers have gone up. I would say almost 75 to 100% within the last 6 months. Yes, 100% in the last 6 months.
Yeah.
This is a smaller group than we normally have.
Yeah.
Fridays we have less than we have on Tuesdays.
Right.
However, this is about double the size that we would have had in September or October. So yes, there has been a dramatic increase. What we're also observing is the day labor pools have dried up or are drying up, and now the skilled labor that works for small contractors, that their jobs are drying up.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have volunteers who come who have worked in corporate America who are now without a job, and they're spending their time helping at the soup kitchen. So you know, that's a way of their giving back. But I'm seeing it all over, and it's just really what it is. It's just there's been a dramatic increase. There's a lack of jobs. Tennessee, I heard this morning, its unemployment rate is now at eight something. Yeah. We happen to have property in a county where it's 20.3%.
Wow.
Which is
in Davidson County?
No. 2 hours west of here.
Okay.
Where it is and that is a rural community where the two big factories shut their doors and there's nothing else.
Right.
So it's widespread and very invasive.
I also talked to a guy named Howard, who's been homeless for a number of years. He and his wife are looking for an affordable place where they can live together. But so far they've had no such luck.
So therefore we got us two tents, and we were thinking about going down to Tent City to live, because a lot of my good associates are down there, and we just decided that I didn't want her down there. When I went down there one day to visit some of my friends, and I saw a young lady that had mosquito bites all over, and it wasn't the right utensils that were down there. They didn't have a porta-johns down there. They didn't have a dumpster down there. So it was kind of like they got it now.
They
got
water.
Yeah. So if you give us the right utensils, you can make it look like a park if you want to, you know. But when you don't have it, it's just bad, you know what I'm saying? And then when people come down and see that, they talk about us.
Yeah.
But you know, we still don't have porta-johns downtown, but we can even use the bathroom. If you see us with a backpack walking through town, you can't go in a hotel and use the bathroom, you know. At the bus terminal, they said just wait until we build this and the homeless will be able to come in and use the bathroom or whatever. But if you don't have a bus pass or whatever, you can't go up there and use the bathroom. If the police see you, because they have
you can't use which bathroom?
At the MTA terminal.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And then after the last bus runs, they have a gate that comes over, and it locks the bathroom up too. So we still, you know, I look at homelessness like the civil rights movement back in the 60s. We're going to have to attack it, and we're going to have to do it like I think underground. Yeah. Just do it. When we see what we need to have, if we could build a bathroom in 24 hours or 8 hours while people are asleep at night and just put it there, that's what we're going to have to do.
Right.
I mean, it's not just for us. It's for everybody, you know?
Downtown.
You're downtown, yeah. Right. And our real shelter is the downtown library, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
We can go in there, but if you can't make it there to use the bathroom, you're in trouble.
Right.
Our parks. They just built, I don't know how many millions, doing the Metro Courthouse Square park. They didn't put a water fountain there.
Right.
Church Street Park across from the library, there's no water fountain there.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's like they're hustling backwards. Things that need to be done aren't being done.
Yeah.
And like I said, we're often talked about and always overlooked.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah.
But it's going to have to start with the homeless community.
Right.
We're going to have to be the ones to change.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to have to, like I say, show love, and we're going to have to come together on one accord.
Yeah.
And the ones that they see up at the park drinking mouthwash or whatever, we're going to have them to go somewhere else and do that, because that's when they stereotype all of us. Yeah. Mental, people with mental problems, some with addiction, some that make bad decisions, you know what I'm saying? But they think we're all the same, and we're not, you know? And it's just really, really sad that that's how they see us. But we do matter, we do count. We used to be something before we became like we are. And when you stay in a shelter, you do the room in the end, it's not intentionally done, but you lose your self-worth.
Yeah.
And anytime you lose your self-worth, it's real bad.
Yeah.
Are you confident that Tent City will be allowed to continue existing?
No. No, they're gonna shut us down.
Yeah.
They're gonna shut us down.
No,
they
ain't.
Yeah. No, they ain't. But they're gonna play hell trying to shut us down.
3 years.
Okay. He's interviewing me, cowboy. Hush.
They ain't gonna shut this down.
I think they will eventually.
No,
they won't. But I'm gonna be up out of here for them.
They can shut it down because they don't want you downtown.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want you.
But they don't want us here either. They don't want us here either.
Yeah.
They've been for 3 years, and they keep saying, well, we're closing this. When I first moved down, they said they was going to close it, said, y'all be out of here in 6 months. That was 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a long fucking 6 months.
Yeah.
I thought my way.
So that was Lisa and her neighbor Cowboy, who both live in Tent City. The municipality threatened to demolish Tent City last November, but there was massive popular resistance to the idea. So the mayor decided to postpone the demolition, and in the meantime set up a commission to hear what the people of Nashville think should be done about homelessness. This is Wendell Seagrove, who's lived in Tent City off and on for about 4 years, and has sort of reluctantly become the community spokesperson.
The first commission meeting I went to about Tent City, the committee there, the commissioners said that there need to be a dumpster down here in Port-a-Johns, and we're going to get Public Works to do it.
Right.
3 months later, private citizens stepped up and got the dumpsters in Port-a-Johns.
Yeah.
You know, I've been nominated for a seat on Homeless Commission because of the work I've been doing, but I'm not sure I'm going to take it.
Yeah.
Because I'm a man of action.
Yeah.
I can't understand talk about something and not doing anything.
Right.
You know, I'd have to get a book, Politics for Dummies, and I don't want to.
Right.
You know, because everybody says, well, I'll have a voice, but it'll be a voice bouncing off the wall. Because all I've seen in these commission meetings is talk, and they have done nothing.
Has this community been growing in the last...
Yeah, that's what all this attention came. There was a lot of people staying over here on a Triangle property, which is private property, and they were trespassing.
Right.
And Metro came in to tell them all to leave, right? And they all came over here. They had a bunch of young kids.
Yeah.
And what happened, it got a little overcrowded, and... Inner City Ministry, the main man there, talked to a guy there, maintenance guy, to try to get a hold of Public Works, see if they can get some dumpsters and porta-johns down here.
Okay,
and then he took it to somebody else, and then that's where the cops got a hold of it, and they just said, well, let's just shut it down.
Right. And that was last summer?
It was last summer.
Yeah, right.
But then it got on the media and the community found out about it, so there's a lot of good people in Nashville.
Yeah.
And they're stepping up, and there's a lot of people, including myself, that are, you know, fighting to keep it open. You know, and I'm not doing it for me. I'm doing it for everybody else. Like I said, about 8-9 months ago, it came to me that this, you know, reason this happened to me, you know, God, you know, took everything from me, put me down there because he wanted me to work with his children. And I asked for a sign, and he gave me the sign, so that's what I've been doing. Now I'm starting to look for a job because it's time to start thinking about myself instead of other people. So, because I know with my dogs, I'm not going to get housing. And my dogs are my children, and I'm not giving my dogs up. So I'm not going to get housing. They're trying to find housing for everybody down here, but that's not going to happen.
Right.
They're not all going to get housing, so it's time for me to start looking for work. And,
right.
You know, once I find a job, I'll get back up. Matter of fact, I'm going to tell you what, when you start doing God's work, and you really start doing God's work, he takes care of you. Since I've been doing this, I was struggling before, but since I've been doing it, I've been wanting for nothing.
Yeah.
Things keep coming to me, you know. And somebody just told me yesterday that if I find a job, they're going to help me get my license back and get a vehicle.
Right.
So I can get to work. So God will take care of me.
Yeah. So what are you, are you kind of asking, because I know there have been a bunch of kind of tent communities in the States that have been sort of integrated and they've been sort of supplied with clean water and stuff like that.
Well, we're actually the only one that's got clean water.
Yeah.
We've got running water, courtesy of Inner City Ministries here, but most of the other camps, they don't.
Yeah.
You know, and it needs to be, you know, these meetings they've been having to see if Nashville needs a sanctioned homeless camp. Yeah, if there's homeless people, for a lot of different reasons, because it's dangerous out there on the street. It's not dangerous here.
Right.
If you're homeless, this is about the safest place you can be.
Right.
You know, because it's community, people look after you. You have a couple bad elements, but that's in any neighborhood, anywhere, you're going to have that, you know. But, if there's camps where the people are together, they've got safe places they can live in, out of the elements, they can lock their stuff up, not having to worry about their stuff getting coming home and everything's gone. All the services can get to them. You know, the food to get to them, people know where to go to bring the food, you know, and everything. It's, they need them.
Yeah.
But we have I don't know if I need to say this, but we have a government here that just doesn't like the homeless. They do not like the homeless. If they had their way, they'd run them all out of town, which is going to create more problems.
Right.
Because if you're someplace where you can't get to services, you can't get no clothes, you can't get no food, you're going to do what you got to do to survive.
Right.
So if that happens, crime rate's going to go up.
Right. Right.
And they're, you know, they ought to be able to see that because they're supposed to be intelligent people.
Right.
But all they care about is these non-entities, the scum of society, which there's not too. There's a lot of good people down here. You know, there are a lot of drunks and drug addicts, granted, but that's all you see.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of good people that their businesses went out of business, their companies folded, they've got foreclosed on, they went to jail and lost everything. There's a million different reasons for people to get down there, and they're all good people.
Yeah.
And if you have programs, which we're trying to get something started, which there's a couple of them that, you know, train people, like you got people in management all their life, and that's all they know.
Right.
If you have something to train them new skills, you know, we're trying to get one going, and I'll volunteer my time to teach anything in construction.
Right.
You know, and it's going to be a year program. After that time, they can get a job if the work's there, making $13, $14, $18 an hour.
Yeah.
You know, and they can survive on that, but they got to learn new skills.
Right.
And there's people, got a friend of mine who owns a restaurant, helps us feed. He's going to teach food service, and got other people going to teach computer skills and how to do resumes and how to dress and present yourself in an interview and stuff.
Yeah.
But there's a couple of them that do that, but there's not enough.
Yeah.
You know. So it's a big battle. It's a heck of a fight. And but there's people like me that aren't going to quit.
Right.
You know. There's a lot of good people here.
I know the police cause you trouble. They cause trouble everywhere. But when you die and go to heaven, you'll find no policeman there. So go to sleep, you weary hobo. Let the towns drift slowly by. Listen to the steel rails humming. That's a hobo's lullaby.
So I'd like to say thanks to Steve Samra, Amy Gallagher, Howard Allen, Lisa Cavoy, and Wendell Seagrove for CKUT. This has been Hustling Backwards. I'm Nico Block.
Yes, the kicked out and forgotten still have a voice. As Van Jones said in his PowerShift 09 address, a rebuilt America will have to include everyone. Everyone. For our second I Report piece, how about this YouTube video presented by just George from California? I like it, George. Just getting out around town, observing what the mainstream media don't find interesting, the little signs of desperation in the falling middle class.
See, guys, this is a typical park in Southern California, at least in my area. As you can count, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There's like 20, 25 cars in the parking lot. It's 10 a.m. in the morning. There's just a couple people with their kids at the park, but I've actually looked in these cars. There's couples sleeping in the cars. There's a guy, you know, living out of his van, smoking a cigarette. And there's a lady over here using the laptop. A lot of these parks have electrical outlets, and people come here, and this is where they hang out. This is the Starbucks where they hang out when they don't have money to buy a cup of coffee. So, you know, this is kind of happening more and more. People don't have work, so they're basically living out of their cars or starting to live out of their cars. I've seen them, guys. There's couples here with cars, with dogs in their cars, and they're sleeping during, they're sleeping right now, or they're just listening to music, just, you know, waiting out the hours, just hanging out. This is the new future here in Southern California. Dead serious, 100%. Hey guys, this is George. We just got done with that Fleetwood story. And the other thing I wanted to address was the whole jobs. I mean, we're getting to a point in Southern California. I mean, on the front page of the New York Times, there's a family, Costa Mesa family, has a picture of a little girl in a bed that are living out of a motel room. So what you're seeing is, you know, California is grabbing the attention of the country. We have tent cities going up in Sacramento. There's a tent city in Ontario. They're popping up all over the place because people can actually live outside. Well, on the front page of the New York Times, what do you have? You have a middle-class family, formerly middle-class, and now they're living out of motels. They're living off of charity, and these were formerly middle-class people. I mean, this is coming to you guys, so, you know, pay attention to California. And here, I'll show you guys. Take a look at this. Over here, this is my local job listings. This is the job listings for my local paper. I don't know if you guys can see that, but, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. There's maybe 15, 20 listings in here out of the whole paper. This is the section we have for employment. And look at the type of jobs you have. An accounting job, a mechanic job. Okay, that makes sense. Cable TV, janitorial, you know, secretary, telemarketer, you know, warehouse. With these type of jobs, this isn't going to sustain people. This isn't going to sustain the economy. This is what type of jobs the economy is producing. They're not middle class, they're below middle class, they're below poverty line jobs. I mean, trust me, I've worked minimum wage jobs or a little bit above minimum wage. Those types of jobs just don't function in the real world. It almost costs you more to have that job than not to have a job at all. You know, you got to pay for your clothes, you got to pay for your gas, you got to pay for your car to get to a job. It almost becomes a zero-sum game. It's almost a gain. It's almost to the point where if you have to work at one of those middle wage jobs, it's better for you just to go collect cans or go collect plastic bottles. So if you guys are right now also, you know, they did an economic poll. You can see here, 96% of Californians are now pessimistic on the economy. 96%. This is now a self-fulfilling prophecy. It doesn't even matter if Obama's stimulus packages seem to work. 96% of the people are pulling back. They're not spending. This is a spiral effect. This is a spiral effect. Get ahead of the game. Cut back everything you can cut back. Try to get your living expenses down to zero as much as possible. And that way, it won't help the economy, but it's going to help you survive. Because what I found out personally is, you know, you can go out, work a minimum wage job, work a couple minimum wage jobs, but you're going to actually find out you're going to lose money in the long run. Find ways to earn money that are close to home, that aren't going to cost you a lot to have. So, hey, this is George reporting on the job situation. It's very bleak. Very bleak indeed.
Check out my blog for the YouTube address for George's video. It's just a park, no car chases, just another sad story. My friends, while watching the U.S. election speeches in November 08, I was struck by one thing. Both candidates spoke for a class. Supposedly McCain and the Republicans spoke for the rich, and Obama for the middle class. He kept saying he spoke for the middle class. No one even suggested that they represented the poor, who are rapidly becoming the majority of Americans. Stunning. Tax cuts mean nothing to people who can't make enough to pay taxes. Refund checks don't reach the people who need the help most, the ones with no address. The media of America, studded with well-paid anchors, and they all have their hair done so nicely, and all the experts appear, and usually they're bald men, and they've blanked out American poverty for, well, as long as I've been alive. Now that a few middle-class types, people who could have been us, are falling down the ladder, suddenly the U.S. networks have discovered tent cities and single moms on welfare. Suddenly, now that we worry we're going there too, and maybe that's why they're showing it to us, just so we can see where we're headed, the poor become visible, at least for a few minutes. How is it the U.S. media managed to ignore horrible poverty for so long?
It's a very tragic occurrence, but I think it's just the beginning. There's about $750 trillion of derivative instruments outstanding that nobody completely understands or can get their arms around.
I've been to a house with three kids where the refrigerator held nothing but a piece of birthday cake and a half-eaten sausage. Nothing in the cupboards but ketchup and sugar packages lifted from a restaurant. Have you mixed ketchup and sugar with hot water to make the last-ditch dinner? The kids couldn't chew a carrot. Their teeth were so bad. Right in the land of billionaires. And no, Mama wasn't an alcoholic or a drug addict. At least they had a home. According to a Harvard study, over 1 million American kids are homeless, and that number is growing. It breaks my heart to even imagine their lives as they shuffle around the world's wealthiest country, seeing all those ads and all those things to buy. It's starting in Canada, and it's there in the UK too, especially in the immigrant community, those who've been refused, but they're still there, and they're living on nothing. I promised you some tips in this show, some things to do in the whirlwind. Here's one, and it goes against what you have been taught. All your life, people have promised upward mobility, marry up, meet the right people, don't associate with those losers, the poor. Now it turns out the most exclusive country club in the most exclusive enclave leads only to Bernie Madoff, to the grand Ponzi scheme of Wall Street. During the next few years, many of us, too many, will become downwardly mobile. We don't know what to expect at all. My personal advice is to get a little more streetwise, to connect with the homeless and the disadvantaged. 2 weeks ago, I visited one of the best centers serving the poor in my hometown of Vancouver, Canada. It's called The Gathering Place, and it's run by the city. It provides a safe meeting place, which includes TV rooms and benches. You know, what a luxury to be able to watch TV. A guarded temporary storage room to put all your stuff in big tubs. And glory be, the all-important free showers. Upstairs, there's a cafeteria where once a day they serve up an all-inclusive $3 dinner, and a lot of people seem to have some sort of scripts or chips or special ways that they could get that dinner for nothing. I don't know about you, but I often learn my most important lessons by embarrassment. When I do something stupid and everybody sees it, I don't forget that easily. So I don't mind telling a story on myself if it might help you. I decided to go for the meal and joined the line. The bearded thin man ahead of me said it would be an hour wait. I believed him, even though a large clear sign announced dinner would be in 15 minutes. Then he disappeared around the corner, saying I had to wait because only two were allowed in at a time. What did I know? The line behind me shoved forward because, well, that was a lie, too. He was just kidding me. My self-appointed guide knew a gullible outsider and had fun with me. But I learned this. As much as I like to brag about sustainability and visits and friends on the poor side of town, I'm still a middle-class mark with few street smarts. How about you? If we really had to live on the streets, we might not last long. Part of the solution is to connect with those who know how to survive in a city when money can't be found. Maybe we can pick up at least a few hours to volunteer at a local homeless shelter, meet people who know hard times and learn from them, look into people's eyes, locate the shelters, the parks, the warm spots for sleeping, the free meals, the Labor Day pickup spots. Try standing on the street for a day. Look around. Meanwhile, maybe you could take some clean water out to the tent city and blankets to the cold people. Do something, feel better, and know we may be helping our future selves or relations and the country. Rule number one, get streetwise now. My second tip will take you in a completely different direction. That is, Do what you can to connect directly with sources of food. I started with locating the food co-ops and small warehouses that distribute food, but we'll deal with bulk orders from individuals. I even found a small granary right on the edge of town. Chat up the vendors at the farmer's market, learn their names. We may need to go further to meet the people who produce our food locally. In Vancouver, there is an organization whose founding purpose was to link food-aware customers with organic growers in the area. It's called Farm Folk City Folk. Check it out at ffcf.bc.ca, ffcf.bc.ca, or just Google Farm Folk City Folk. This is a model organization which you could set up in your own city. A listener sent in another great tip, which resulted in this interview. Down in the concrete city, not everybody has the gardening skills or a place to grow their own food. Here is a great idea. Valerie Gates is an award-winning designer in the Boston area. Let's listen to her technique for getting by in hard times. It's called We'll Work for Food, but it's not what you think. Valerie, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, so Valerie, do you stand out in the street with the classic down and out sign?
No, this is a little more sophisticated. I thought of this project at Christmas time when I was reading Kingsolver's book, Animal Vegetable Miracle, and also Michael Pollan's book, Omnivore Dilemma. I realized after I read the book two things. One, that these small farms don't have any marketing budget, and therefore they're not able to compete with the larger farms, and it's something that they definitely need. And two, that as a mother of two, my children really didn't know where food came from. So I tried to kill two birds with one stone starting this project.
And could you just tell us, how does your project work?
Well, it started by offering a three-tiered process for local farms. The first tier would be that I would work with five farm partners doing their design work, their websites, their branding, their brochures, in exchange for their organic produce or food, which in turn I would feed my family, feed my children, and blog about it on the website, We'll Work for Food Project. And the second tier would be 75% off our studio rates for farms. The third tier would be 50% off our rates. And the fourth tier would be a phase-out 25% off our rates.
And what do you do for the farmers?
We do everything from creating logos and branding for them to websites, to brochures, to farm signs, bumper stickers, you name it. Anything, any kind of design they need, but also we offer them a healthy dose of marketing advice and help with getting press and media kits and everything a business needs to get press and get noticed these days.
I think that's just such a great idea. How did you discover local small growers in your area?
Well, I personally did not have any experience with too many local growers, so I contacted CMAP, which is the Southern New England, Southern Eastern Massachusetts Agriculture Program, and I found out about them and put a small blurb in their newsletter on a Friday in February, and by Monday I had 15 farms that had contacted me. So I looked to see where the farms are located, what kind of produce they had, what their needs were for marketing, spoke to them, and decided on the first five to work with on the trade barter basis.
And what are these operations like? I mean, I presume they're not agribusiness, so are they mainly family farms?
Yes, but the good majority are family farms. A lot of them are husband and wives, and I was really impressed with and surprised by the age group that I was finding. I was finding lots of young couples with young children starting farms. Maybe that's a renaissance in the past couple years, but my impression of a farmer was pretty archaic until I went out and met these farmers, and a lot of them are in their 30s. A lot of them have small children and actually live on the farm, and it's very hard work. It's many hours getting up before dawn and not finishing till way after dark. But it seems to be a lifestyle that's catching on with a younger crowd. So part of the marketing that I've found important is to create a hipness to farming. We're doing T-shirts. We're doing logos that are fun and young and hip and sort of following, the life is good style branding and making farming fun again and attractive to younger farmers and younger eaters as well.
I'm so happy to hear this. You've shattered my image of the old New England farmer who's dying out and there'd be nobody left.
I know. I think it's wonderful. A lot of these young couples are finding farms from their grandparents or buying farms from the older generation. And they're very interested in splashy branding. They're very savvy. They understand that branding's important. And they're interested in having a bright, great image. So if you go on our blog, you'll see one I did was for Frog Acres Farm. And it's a very, it looks like a poster design. It's a frog leaping over a sunflower. And it's not your dad's Oldsmobile. It's definitely the new wave of farm branding. And I'm having a lot of fun with it because I can really connect to a younger group and help these farms change their image.
Do you have tips about people, you know, when they start to make these kind of connections with local food producers about how you develop these kind of relationships? Do you take it slow or do you just come out and say, well, here, this is who I am and this is mm-hmm. what I do? Or?
Well, I think it's really important to go to the farm and to visit the farm and spend a lot of time on the farm with the animals, see what's grown, see what they provide, see what kind of landscape they have, and see how big they want to be, because some farms don't have the capabilities of providing food for a large number of people. So we have to be careful about building too big or too grand a website for them so that those farms would attract more of a local crowd than somebody who wants to have more of a regional reach. But I think every farm is quirky. Each farm has personality, and I think you have to go and meet the farmers and see what kind of personality they want to portray their farm as. And again, the food is different too. I have a woman down in Rhode Island who does eggs, and she's known as the Egg Lady, and she has these wonderful green eggs. So we're definitely creating a logo that has chicken and eggs in it for her because that's part of her brand equity.
Well, now we just need the green ham to go with it.
I've yet to find that. I don't know if I'd want to eat that if it was green.
No, I wouldn't either. Well, we're just about out of time. Can you tell us what's next for you or any other tips you'd like to offer and then give us your website, please?
Sure. The website is willworkforfoodproject.com. That's where I'm blogging about the farms, the work I do with the farms, and as well as my family's eating habits and how that's changing. This project is really taking off. We're thinking of expanding into seasonal dinners where we bring the farmer to the city and talk about food and have gourmet chefs cook the meals seasonally. But we're also talking about a TV show where we would do the same thing. And that would be a seasonal, how do you cook what's in season? How do you cook 10 pounds of broccoli? And how many meals can you make from that? Because seasonally, things come in at different times. And so it's a different challenge on how to cook with seasonal and local food. So we really are expanding, and stay tuned.
That's great stuff. That's Valerie Gates from the Gates Studio near Boston. Valerie, thank you so much for coming on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for having me.
Do you have skills that could help connect you with food growers? All sorts of alternative economics are popping out of the current crisis. One organic apple grower lets city dwellers adopt a tree. When harvest time comes, you get whatever that tree gives. You assume some of the risk, help the farmer who likely can't get any credit anyway, and may end up with a bumper crop of some great organic apples. Personally, I've had an invite to go out and speak in an agricultural area. Likely it will be a very small audience, but I'll go, just to start making friends and laying down roots where the food is. Tip number two, develop direct connections to local food producers however you can. On to tip number three, adopt a place to run away to. Chances are you will be stuck in the city. But what if roving armed gangs make city living unhealthy? What if disease or simple lack of food supply means you have to get out? Or a hurricane wrecks the town beyond immediate rebuilding? There are so many reasons, including the climate, which might drive you to seek another location, so you might as well develop a plan B ahead of time. I suggest checking out maps, figuring out gas supplies or getaway routes when the freeways are plugged, and pick a place you might want to go. Those with the money should go ahead and buy a cheap country place or at least a plot of land now. That's the best insurance and investment you will ever make, in my opinion. If you're really broke, try doing it with a group of people. We did that just a few years ago. Even if you can't buy, pretend. Get detailed maps of the area. Go camping in that place if you can. Figure out where the ducks land and the deer go. Introduce yourself to local farmers. Maybe even stash a few tools in a shed. Consider where you could squat in an emergency and grow some food. Check out the weather stats. Is there enough rain or river water for your garden? How long is the growing season? What do you need to know? It may seem like an imaginary exercise now, but it could provide you with at least some landing knowledge if you had to move, and millions of us will have to move in the coming years or decades. Finally, tip 4, something you can easily do now, print out a survival binder and get a few books. Sure, it's all there on the internet, but you need a home to get the net regularly, and the net easily could go down. It's so easy now to get a few simple, good recipe books for cooking and books on how to store food. The old standard Joy of Cooking tells you how to prepare anything, and Putting Food By is the Bible of food preservation. I keep finding important survival tips on the net, but if my hard drive goes bust or I can't afford the power bills due to a lost income, then what? So I print out the best into a survival binder. At least I'll have that, and I could rip out the most important pages for my backpack if I have to hit the road in a hurry for some reason. And just like the last depression, there will be millions of migratory people, even in the developed countries. That means where you live. Add climate change, and it could be that migratory living will be even more common. In fact, that's how the first North Americans lived. That tells you about the real resource base here, once fossil fuels are removed and the climate shifts. I get out and walk every day with a backpack some days, just to be ready and able to move. Oh, and it adds years to your life, no matter what happens. 4 quick tips this week for hard times. Connect with the poor and get street smart. Meet your local food producers. Adopt a place to go if you need to leave the city. And print out and practice the knowledge you might need. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and that's all I've got to say about that. You have been listening to Radio EcoShock. Our opening riff came from Beck's Gamma Ray. Be sure and tune in and get all our free programs from the website at ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org. Thank you so much for listening.
Well, as thousands of people find themselves out of work and uncertain about where the next job is going to come from, a Hamilton man is hoping he can help them feel like they're not alone. Ramo Sino is a victim of the U.S. steel shutdown that put almost 2,200 people out of work. The emotion and stress of losing his job was enough that he put his feelings to music and wrote a song that now has a growing following on YouTube.
That was from CHCH-TV in Hamilton, and here, with his permission, is Ramo Sino singing Everything Comes at a Price.
I can't believe that I have to say that Daddy won't be going to work, not today. They say they don't need me, and I couldn't stay. And I don't know why my child has to see a mother and father lost in disbelief. The house feels much colder, we're all losing sleep. All we can do now is pray that good sense will somehow find its way. I never thought that I'd see the day when the factory sends all the workers away. The man on the corner is begging for some kind of change. And I never dreamed that I'd live to tell that my country gave in and sent us all to hell. I guess everything comes at a price and we're all up for sale. Good men and good women have given their blood, their sweat and their tears all this time, all for what? They're closing the doors and they're shutting us out. For almost 100 years we could say, we're proud of our city, we're proud of what we made. Now our children's children won't know what we gave. All we can do now is fight, pray our brothers and sisters unite. Cause I never thought that I'd see the day when the factory sends all the workers away and the man on the corner is begging for some other change. And I never dreamed that I'd live to tell that my country gave in and sent us all to hell. I guess everything comes at a price, and we're all up for sale.
What kind of world have we made that my child has to pray for me? I'm afraid that we'll all go hungry and we'll lose our home. And if I say I'm not scared, then I'm lying. I'll be strong and I'll still keep on trying. But I can't make the promise that it won't take long. 'Cause I never thought that I'd see the day when the factory sends all the workers away and the man on the corner stopped begging me for some change. And I never dreamed that I'd live to tell that my country gave up and sold us all to hell. I guess everything comes at a price, we're all up for sale.